good evening. I'm Marshall. I'm an alcoholic. I tell time kind of like an alcoholic, too. Oh, well, didn't quite... Please, that would be lovely. Yeah, left mine in the car. Thank you, Billy. I do have a sobriety date. It's the 30th day of April of 1995. I do have a home group. It's the Jay Walkers Group in Richmond, Virginia. Actually over in Bon Air, scenic, sunny, less than popular Southside. At least that's the way it was when I was growing up. We meet on Tuesdays. Of course, I'm never there on Tuesdays because I go up and see some of you nice folks up in Buckingham County. We also meet on Fridays, which I'm at almost every time, and because that's what my sponsor tells me I should do. I was never much on doing what I should do. I always wanted to do what I wanted to do, and quite frankly, that's why I'm a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. Some days the only part of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I get right is the not drinking part. There are a lot of days where that thing we call self-will, which I like to think of as my thinking, gets in my way a lot. I spent a lot of my life being in my own way. I spent a lot of time in my head. I spent a lot of time being my own worst enemy. These are the kinds of things that were part and parcel. They were a way of life. You know, come to find out, these are the parts and parcels of alcoholism. Just a few of them. The drinking was a symptom. My story is probably not any more significant or substantial than anybody else's. Worse than some, not as bad as others, you know, but that's really not what makes anything we say around here unique or special or different. What I think does that is the what happens once we get in here, you know, once we try to adopt this way of life, the way we adopted the drinking way of life as a way of life, and that's not to put down the whole disease concept. I do believe that alcoholism is a disease, but it's definitely a life choice as well. There are a whole lot of things, the accoutrements that went with the drinking, you know, all the little paraphernalia and stuff, the little rituals, but you know, more so is believing my own stuff, if you will. Believing that somehow, some way, in spite of all the mountain of evidence to the contrary, that I could fix me. And that was one of the great old ideas, you know, it talks about in our literature. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was, in fact, nil, nil meaning nothing, until we did what? We let go absolutely. It's the absolute part, you know. I had problems with absolutes. I had problems with them then. I still have problems with them today. But at least I'm willing to turn stuff loose. Most of the tough stuff I have turned loose has got claw marks all over it. I don't always turn it loose willingly. But piece at a time, I get there. And they tell me that this is progress, not perfection. But the thing about progress, not perfection, you know, the way my head works, I can use that as a cop-out also. I can, I'm progressing, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Yeah, sometimes almost imperceptibly, too. And if I'm too close to the imperceptible part, I'm probably not progressing much. And, you know, quite frankly, if I'm standing still, I'm going backward. The way things work, you know, the disease is progressive. The recovery kind of has to be progressive, too. You know, I hear people say, my disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups. Well, who cares what it's doing? You know, I really can't spend time anymore. I spent all my life focusing on problems. And I need to focus on solutions today. My second sponsor told me once upon a time that, bless his heart, that I had one shot at identifying the problem. Anything further beyond that constituted whining, and he was not in the business of listening to me whine. I heard him on that one, and I sort of adopted that. I need to become solution oriented today, is what I do. We have a solution here. You know, mercifully, it's a solution for people like us. You know, if you're a hopeless drunk, you're in the right place. You're in business. And quite frankly, if you're here for much of anything else, I've come to believe and have seen, you're probably wasting your time and some of ours as well. And having been booting around for a while, you know, I've had an opportunity to watch people who are comparing as opposed to identifying, if you will. And when I got here the last time, I was pretty well out of the comparing business. I had spent a lot of time comparing. I had compared what you looked out like on the outside to how I felt on the inside. I had compared the way your lifestyle was with the way my lifestyle was. And, you know, every time I ever did that, I came up wanting. I always felt like I was lacking. I never felt good enough. And toward the end of my drinking career, it was really tough to compare myself into crowds where, I could actually make myself feel better with the company I was hanging around with. Our literature mentions seeking lower companionship. Well, as my friends disappeared during the course of my drinking, I discovered, looking back on it, that what happened was I became lower companionship. Mama never raised me that way. Mama tried to raise me with some values and principles and standards, and thanks to my drinking career, I violated just about every single one of those values and principles and standards. I was not the kid who stood up in front of first grade when everybody was saying things like, I want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a cop or a nurse or whatever, and said, I want to develop a hopeless, progressive, fatal disease that will land me a permanent seat in Alcoholics Anonymous and I want to accumulate some stuff and then drink it all away. I don't think any of us ever says that. You know, who set out to wind up here? I know I didn't. But today, I know what people mean when they say things like, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad I'm an alcoholic with a solution. I wasn't glad to be an alcoholic while I was out there working on my first step, adding to my story. That wasn't a whole lot of fun. But I always remember, Mama tried. Bless her heart. Mama tried really hard. I had this problem hearing. She'd say this, I'd hear something else. Somehow, even at a very early age, the rules never applied. You know, what was good for you was never good for me. What you were supposed to do was never what I was supposed to do. Somehow, my case was different. Somehow, I was unique. Special, whatever. And I don't know where that notion came from. It just was part of my makeup. I know that there are plenty of alcoholics in my family tree, and that is, who cares? My immediate parents, immediate family at home growing up, I'm it. My parents didn't drink much when I was little. We had booze in the house. It rarely got consumed. Although I can remember, I always wanted a sip of it when it came down off the shelf and got dispensed on the rare occasions it did. And usually I got one. I remember being about 8 years old visiting my grandfather, and that's where I got my first quote-unquote mixed drink, which was a splash of a little booze in the bottom of a big glass full of 7-Up or something disgusting like that. And, it looked like a mixed drink. I don't remember any kick to it, but it was the whole concept. And, of course, I wanted another one, and the answer was no. And from that point on, the chase was on for me to drink the way I wanted to drink. every chance I got. First, swipe some booze from some kid across the street. His dad had a liquor cabinet, and we went over one summer's afternoon and swiped a little of this and a little of that, and God knows what concoction we made, but, you know, I finally discovered it. All that, you know, how insecure can an 11-year-old feel? Well, I think an 11-year-old future drunk can feel pretty darned insecure and pretty darned inadequate. Unpopular, whatever. I like the effect alcohol produced in me. And then the chase was really on to get the effect in addition to trying to drink. And that's the way my high school career went. My grades took a distinctive turn south at that point. Of course, I also went to a different school that year, too. I remember my mother telling me, this is going to be a very difficult school. You're going to have to do a lot of homework. Your standards are high. You're really going to have to work your butt off. You can't coast. What I heard is, you ain't going to make it. You're not good enough. I'm setting you up to fail. So I did. Well, I didn't flunk out, but, you know, I think I graduated in the half of the class that made the other half possible. You know, you've got to have a foundation for everything, right? Yeah, I understood the foundation part. Social life there wasn't hitting on much. You know, I always was one of those people who always had one or two friends. I was never part of the in crowd. I never was in the clique. That just wasn't one of the things I did. Of course, after I realized that I wasn't going to fit in, I tried everything I could do to make it look like it was my choice. Yeah, this is what I think. You know, I'm just too cool for you. I'm so sorry. Yeah, you can make a lot of noise when you're marching to the beat of a different drummer, but the truth is when you're spending the whole time feeling like a square peg and you know you ain't going in that round hole, why bother? And I got real good at being an underachiever. I got real good at being antisocial. Disgustingly so, and even dangerously so from time to time. I was opinionated. I was noisy about it. And yet, I always seemed to have one or two or three people around from time to time. they must have been as sick as I was. I don't know. I went away to college after I finished up high school. I wanted to drink beer and dabble in drugs and chase girls, not necessarily in that order. And I wasn't about the academia, and I picked a non-party school to go to. What was I thinking? That lasted about two semesters, and whereas I could have gone back, boy, it would have been an uphill climb after that. And, you know, for an underachiever, we don't like uphill climbs too much. Let's take the easier, softer way. So I said, oh, to heck with that, and went to work. I dated this one woman for a while and continued to while she went through college, and we got married a couple weeks after she graduated from college. Of course, she went on to get a good job and start the upwardly mobile, yuppie-looking life, and she had this clunk she had married for a husband. You know, I talked a good game, but as far as producing it, yeah, it was like when I dropped out of college that I went on summer break, and, you know, lo and behold, I woke up 20 years later and was still on summer break. That was about how responsibly I approached adulthood. And I was a terrible burden for this poor woman. And one day she woke up and realized she was tired of footing the bills and tired of getting abused emotionally and getting unsupported in any other particular way. Anything I did, of course, and that was part of my attitude too, you know. I expected kudos for doing what it was I should have done anyway. And, of course, kudos were not forthcoming, and when they were not, I raised hell about it. Very, very juvenile way of approaching things. And people, this wears people out after a while. They get really tired of putting up with it. And, I, you know, of course, I had worn her out by this time, and she announced one Sunday morning that she had decided she didn't want to be married anymore. And I said, well, I'm not going to stick around long enough to hear you say that a second time. So I packed my crap and moved home to Mother. I've been known to joke that that was the mature thing to do. Why my mother had me back, I couldn't bloody tell you, but she did. Of course, her marriage had just tanked at that point. That's kind of weird when you're in your mid-20s and your parents divorce. But, hey, it's just one more excuse to drink over, right? Like we needed one. And of course, my drinking was part and parcel with the failure of my marriage. And actually, as that marriage was tanking, was in the process of tanking, you know, my drinking problems had got to the point where, you know, I decided a nice 28-day stay, funded by my wife's insurance plan at a lovely treatment center, would be just the month-long vacation I needed so I could learn how to manage more effectively, like I knew how to manage in the first place. And that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was about 22 years ago last month, as I recall. I went and spent the, come to think of it, standing here, 22 years ago today, I got out of that treatment center. My mind catalogs dates. I don't work to remember this stuff, honest to Pete. My head just remembers dates for no good reason. If I had to work at it, that would be way too hard. So anyway, yeah, 22 years ago tonight, this morning, I guess, I would have gotten out of that treatment center. And I remember she came down and picked me up and read me the Riot Act all the way from Greensboro back to Richmond. And I sat there in the car feeling like a complete victim. Why me? Can't you appreciate the great lengths I'm going to try to be a better person, to try to be whatever it was, whatever lies I was telling. I have no idea what I said, but I'm sure it was all tripe. 9 months later, you know, packed up and moved home to Mom's. Which was funny because the career I was in at that point had tanked about the same time. I've had a couple, three instances in my life where everything hits the swirling water at the same time. And, pity me, I'm back on square one again. What do I do now? It'll make a body real thirsty. Somehow I managed not to drink for a while. I managed to catch another woman who was dumb enough to say, I will. And she did. And, about 3 years later, I'm a resident in my mother's house again. This time I've got another ex-wife, or ex-wife-to-be, and a son. And I'm borrowing money from my mother routinely to make my support payments because, you know, I'm still working like they look a lot like summer jobs. Pretty ridiculous stuff. And, of course, I had managed to fall off the wagon in that time, too, because I'd never really heard anything beyond the don't drink or go to meetings part of stuff. And a lot of this stuff, you know, I'm not real proud of. The thing about it is that happens. There is one of the promises in our book that says we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I'm reminded that these are the kinds of things that, I don't know who it might help one day, but somewhere somebody will hear that something and say, yeah, that's the way I did too. So that's my experience. That's what I did. I finally... While I was married to number two, I had got my career back on an upward track, but, you know, as the marriage went down, the career went down at the same time as well. Of course, by that time, I had started back drinking, and no surprises there. I remember at that job I was working at, I went to a Christmas party that the division manager had thrown at his house. And the last thing I remember was leaving there after having drunk just about everything I could pour down my throat. You know, it was New Year's Eve. And it's amazing how many people, when toasting the new year, will have their sip of their champagne glass and set it down. And if you appoint yourself the person to clean up the champagne glasses, you can drink about 3 bottles in 10 minutes, hauling all the glasses back to the kitchen, which, of course, was what I did. I've got a sneaking suspicion I made a complete ass out of myself before I left, but I can't prove it. My memory's a little fuzzy about that particular evening. I do remember coming out of a blackout about 6 o'clock that morning, standing there in a suit, mud up to my knees, where I've been four-wheeling on foot. No vehicle to be found. The only way I knew where I was as my eyes slowly came into focus, was reading the street signs. And I'm on the phone with Ma to come get me at 6 o'clock in the morning. Turns out I called her at about, 2 or 2:30. She's been up all night worrying about her poor benighted prodigal son. And it was not until years later that I realized the incredible inconsideration of that whole act. And, you know, truth is, if she had told me to go to hell and rot, she probably would have done me no disservice. She may have done more of a disservice by coming to get my dumb, silly, muddy, drunk, cold derriere off the corner of the road. I could have understood today why she hadn't, but, nevertheless, of course, I caught an earful. I probably had 2 or 3 excuses, but my truck didn't surface for about another 4 days. Turns out it was parked at least shiny side up in the ravine behind Virginia State Police headquarters on Midlothian Turnpike in Richmond, and I have no idea how it got there other than the fact I think I drove it there looking for a shortcut or something. So the state police calling, yeah, your truck's in the ravine behind our headquarters here. I'd like to come get it out. So I did. And the keys are still in. No, actually, the keys are in my pocket. It's one of those damn guys who works for me, you know. I work for somebody else. I didn't have any employees. But anyway... You know, why didn't I walk out into their waiting arms when I staggered out of that hole? No idea. And that went on, you know, there's some things that happen. You know, you realize at some point in your drinking career that you know, you don't set out to get that stupid drunk. You don't set out to be a horse's ass every time you open your mouth. You know, you don't set out to be a lousy husband, a lousy boyfriend, a lousy employee, a lousy child, a lousy parent on purpose. You know, it's like the little kid who doesn't say he wants to be an alcoholic when he's in first grade. You don't intend to do all these things, but you realize at some point that every time you pick up a drink, you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. And if you're like a lot of us, you keep drinking a few more years. And I did. I met a woman at one point I thought was perfect. She drank like I did. And a year later, when she's booting me to the curb, she's telling me it's because of my drinking. What an ingrate. Of course, that was Mr. Perfect, right? I don't think so. at that point, I'd gotten into a little trouble and decided I could went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, hung around about 3 months, and decided I really didn't need you nice people, but you know, well-meaning, but you know, you've got to be kidding me, right? Y'all are just too sticky, gooey, whatever it is, to be real, and I don't think so. I can do this on my own. We are a defiant lot, aren't we? So I did. You know, if you grit your teeth and clench your fists tight enough, you cannot drink for a while if you're a drunk like me. And I actually made it an amazingly long time. got career back running a little bit. Got some trappings of lifestyle. Of course, I'm still living at mom's, but I'm getting closer and closer to 40 as every year goes by. But anyway, the day finally comes. I'm working at this place, making more money than I've ever made in my life, and it's a bunch of drinkers. And the day finally comes where my office buddy there, and don't think I'm completely clean through this time because I'm still dabbling in the occasional roll-your-own green, leafy, very dry martini. But the day finally comes where I pick up my last first drink. There's a story in the big book where it talks about a guy named Jim who's fairly normal in every respect other than his nervous disposition and the effect that alcohol has on him. And I like that story a lot because Jim cops a resentment one day and goes to he's in the car business and he takes a car out to sell it and he says he's getting the hell out of the office is what he's doing. And he rides out to a roadside joint where he'd had lunch a couple times before, decides to stop and have lunch, and has a sandwich and a glass of milk, and then he has another, and then the thought occurs to have a drink and on a full stomach and a glass of milk. It won't bother him, right? Right. Okay, sure. Well, you know, the thing that Jim says is, I had the big, and I'm not going to quote this because I can't remember it exactly, and I gave up big book quoting years ago, save for one sentence. But he said, yeah, he had the vague sensation he was being none too smart. And I was at work one day, and this, one evening after we closed, I think it was a Sunday afternoon when we closed fairly early. And, my office buddy pours a little bitty Dixie cup, about half full of this delectable new malt beverage that I had never tried. And there pushes across the table and says, quote, here, this little bit won't kill you. Well, obviously I'm standing here, it didn't. But it sure tried to. Because literally within a matter of no more than 5 minutes, and probably more like two or three, I'm in the refrigerator getting a full one. And he said, hey, what are you doing? You don't drink. I said, well, I had that little bit, and if I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink. Alcoholic's last words. And I proceeded. That was the beginning of my last hoorah, last debauch, if you will. And I didn't learn till a year or so later that none of this should have come as any surprise. Because when I pour alcohol into myself, and you know, that's just the last of many episodes. When I pour alcohol in me, my body orders the next drink and the one after that and the one after that, in spite of my best thinking, in spite of what I want, in spite of what I know to be true, in spite of what I aspire for, I become a drinking machine. And that's the only thing I can count on is drinking once booze gets in my system. You know, couple that with the fact that sooner or later, left unaided, I will drink again. And my experience has proven that more times than I care to count as well. Because, of course, there was that extended period of not drinking. But, you know, there were also those days. I mean, I was probably in my late teens when I first had those days where I'd wake up in the morning. I'll never do that again and be drinking by sundown. And I couldn't tell you how many times that happened. Anyway, that last hoorah landed me in some more legal trouble, and I remember standing there in front of the judge with the attorney I hired, and, you know, the sentence is getting passed, and, of course, part of this is going to include going to ASAP, which is going to, I know is going to include going back to see you silly people. And I leaned over to the lawyer and said, can we negotiate the ASAP for more jail time? He said, shut up. And I didn't like that. And I was paying him for crying out loud. Actually, I had already paid him in full by that point. I guess he was paid in full. He could talk to me any way he wanted to, huh? anyway, I put off going to the AA meetings absolutely to the last dying minute. I had hired a shrink at this point, too, and gone to the psychiatrist. And surprise, surprise, I was diagnosed as being clinically depressed. One of the things I've learned is that, you know, and it says so in the Bedevilments, you know, we're a prey to misery and depression. Well, I had the misery. Of course, the girlfriend had to kick me to the curb after I got popped that last time. And, you know, I'm having some trouble at work. And you know, of course, I've got all this legal mess going on. And friends are falling away by the wayside. And soon I'm walking. My driving privileges were terminated for a while. And, yeah, I realized during that last winter that my phone never rang unless it was a bill collector. Nobody called. I spent that winter in Mama's basement when I wasn't at work, smoking green, leafy, very dry, roll-your-own martinis, not drinking. And some people would call that addiction. I don't. I call it controlled drinking because, you know, if I was stoned all day, every day, I wasn't drinking for a while. And mostly I was getting plenty miserable enough. I was sitting at a crummy old desk in a crummy old chair and I stared at a concrete block wall about as far as from me to that back wall. And I became intimately familiar with the patterns of the holes in the concrete blocks because I stared at it that much. And I spent my time wondering how this could have happened to a nice guy like me. I didn't deserve this. Why me? Oh, boo-hoo. And I had no answer. Our book describes the four horsemen, the terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And yeah, I was scared. Yeah, I was clueless. Yeah, I was frustrated. I was raging angry at everything. And I really get angry at frustration, you know? That's one of the things. And despair, no hope. I didn't have any hope because this wasn't working. So I finally went to those AA meetings I was sentenced to the last time. And, you know, once I was back to mobile again. And the funny thing was I kept going. I fulfilled the few requirements that I had to as far as the court system was concerned. And I kept going to AA meetings. Part of that was if I wasn't working, I had nowhere to go and I had all day to get there. That's how many people were left in my life at that point. I hear people talk about, well, you know, I have to worry about not hanging out with my old buddies. They were all gone. I didn't have to worry about them. They were all gone. Because it seems I was such an angry, mean, nasty, surly SOB that nobody wanted to spend any time with me. And, of course, I thought it was their fault, how delusional I was. But something happened when I went to those AA meetings. I finally, I guess, started hearing what it is we talk about around here. And if you had to put it in one word, that one word would have to be hope. I can't think of anything else you would call it. I think that's what I heard. I was a little fuzzy at the time, but that's what I heard. And finally, on the last day of April of 1995, at about 4:05 in the South Richmond Clubhouse, I dragged myself out of a folding metal chair, not unlike these, got up, walked around the table, and went over and picked up what I hope will be, knock wood, my last white chip. I do know that if I continue not to drink and to continue to attempt to do what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous suggests, I won't have to drink again. You know, and I believe that. What has taken me a long time to learn from that moment to this one, and I think I mentioned it earlier, but it bears repeating. You know, there's more to quitting drinking than quitting drinking. And I began to learn the intricacies of that as time went on. The first old guy that sat me down, I was about a week sober, gruff old cuss with one eye that looked this way and one eye that looked that way, and at no point did an eye really look at you. And if one accidentally happened to pass by you, the other one was pointing off God knows where. Big old Santa Claus beard, wild hair. And he was the one old cuss in that room. I figured if I had to have a go at this guy, he'd probably kick my head up somewhere that I can't mention from a podium. And I asked him if he'd talk to me for a few minutes because I knew he sounded like a hard case, and I figured maybe I might be one too. And for the next 2 hours, he agreed, and for the next 2 hours, he gave me a little lesson in two things. One of them was step one, and the other one was tradition five. Because he didn't want to hear a single thing that I had to whine about, which was ex-wives, kids that didn't know, living at mom's, crummy living situation, I was so oppressed, my lousy job, money problems, yada, yada, yada. He didn't want to hear any of that stuff. The only thing he wanted to know was what I was willing to do about my drinking. Because that really is what it's about around here. What am I willing to do about my drinking? And in doing so, he explained to me what they had told him to do. And, of course, the big book came up. Well, I had bought one. I actually had gone home and looked for the old big book I had and couldn't find it, so I bought a new one. And that $3,000 big book I'd gotten in treatment, I don't know what became of that. Yeah, that was back in the good old days when treatment was real cheap. I don't understand big books are 30, 40 grand anymore, maybe more, depending on where you go. AA will sell you one for, what, $7? Whatever. It's a bargain, a whole lot cheaper than my last drunk, I know that. And I started reading that big book because, you see, I didn't sleep very well. And the first 30 days I was sober, I had read the thing, and I started at the inside cover, and I read it all the way through the last appendix, which, as I recall, is a list of AA literature. Not read all the AA literature, but I've read a big, just about all of it. I think I'm missing a few pamphlets these days. No brag, just what happened, you know. But the line that I remember foremost, and the one I will quote, is top of page 47. It says, "When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God." And I had seen that because about a week after I talked to this old cuss, another crotchety little guy came over and appointed himself my sponsor, and I said, okay. And he then proceeded to say something which he probably didn't say, but I heard, because this guy was a loud, noisy, militant atheist. But what I heard come out of his mouth sounded a lot like, what you need to do, boy, is read the big book and find God. Finding God ain't that big a problem, boy, because everything you need to know about God is contained in the first portion of the big book. And intellectually, I was standing there just about ready to explode with intellectually prided rebellion. And I opened my mouth, and out of my mouth came the word, okay. Maybe God had begun to work in my life. Well, looking back on it, there's no doubt it did. All, you know, when you toss in all the stupid stuff I used to do, and the fact that I survived any of it, you know, it's testament to the fact that something was keeping me alive, if nothing else. Maybe it wasn't done with me yet. I like to think so. And somehow I was able to clear the God hurdle with a lot less trouble than I thought I was going to. Intellectually, I had declared war against God somewhere about, I don't know, age 19 or so. I was just wasn't going to have any more of that. And I'll show you God. I'll spell the G word with a little G, not a capital one. You know, this was how my intellectual arrogance ran. And yet somehow I was back in the God camp again, and I didn't really know how it happened. So then I'm looking at making a decision. Okay. Well, and I'd always kind of wondered about that, but I did what the guy told me to do, which isn't what our literature tells us to do, what the big book tells us to do. And I do believe today that in order to take the steps, it helps to have a big book, and it helps to have a sponsor who's taken the steps with a sponsor out of the big book. There's a very simple reason for that. It's contained in the sentence that says something to the effect of, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. AA is the first thing that's worked to cure drunks in recorded history on a consistent basis. But I did what the guy said, and, you know, I remembered probably about 4 months sober. I was riding home one afternoon, and I was feeling sorry for myself. And I asked a question in my head that sounded something like, God, what have you done for me lately? And within about 5 minutes, it dawned on me that, you know, hey, dummy, when was the last time you wanted a drink? Oh. Because I couldn't remember, and it had been a while. And it wasn't those darned antidepressants, because at 32 days sober, I got canned from the last crummy job I had. And which meant when I went to see the shrink next week, I told him, I'm unemployed. No more money equals no more appointments. No more appointments, no more prescriptions. No more prescriptions, no more antidepressants. And that was the end of that. And, you know, so I was as clear-headed as I was going to get. Oh, and I haven't wanted to drink in a while. And I didn't do that because I could never do that. And that was only up to half measure standards, really. That was kind of interesting. I started, I found another sponsor at this time, and he had gotten me started on an inventory. And, you know, it wasn't a book inventory there either. It was the ever popular Joe and Charlie sheets. And, you know, but I managed to get some results from that because I did manage to find out a few things about myself, and I did. Was willing to share some stuff with another human being that I had stuffed for years. And the nice thing about that was at least beginning to feel a part of. by this time also, I had met a number of you people around here, and I actually had some phone numbers, and I actually talked to some of you, and I actually hung out with some of you, and I was getting over some of my antisocial garbage. Slowly, but getting there. You know, I've since done several inventories since then, and, you know, anymore when I do one, I do the Mr. Brown list straight out of the big book, and I read the directions every time I do one. There's a reason for that. It's called Rarely Have We Seen a Person Fail Who Has Thoroughly Followed Our Path. And quite frankly, you know, anymore it's not about the drinking problem. You know, I've got some distance between me and my last drink. But, you know, I was thinking coming up here. I've still got a thinking problem, and my mind is still not my friend, and it doesn't seem to want to cuddle up to me too much these days either. I've got to keep an eye on that because I can still build resentments. I can still be fear driven. I can still take my will back, and I'm subject to pretty much every time I don't get what I want. Or I'm afraid I'm going to lose what I have. The difference today when I do an inventory is, as I get through the end of the process and I'm sharing this with another person, I get this really disgusting, slimy feeling about myself, and it's amazing. You know, we got step 6 and 7 that toddle on right behind that. And, you know, if you've got an icky, disgusting feeling, you can be really, really willing to have that go away. And that's really slick. You can just say, okay, God, I can't fix this. Have at it. My last big load of resentments and stuff, which I probably tabled about a year and a half ago, I remember going home and doing that step 6 and 7, and that was the longest hour. That step 6 was the longest bloody hour I'd spent in years. I spent hours in jail that passed quicker than that. But I was willing. You know, the big difference was I was willing. And, you know, I've come to believe that it's not so much that the defects of character have left, is that the motivation to act on them is just not there today. And I didn't do that because I couldn't do that by myself. That seemed to be the big difference. You know, it's amazing things that come out of my mouth that I did not open my mouth to say. I opened my mouth to say something wise or hostile, And that's just not what comes out. What comes out is something agreeable or compliant, or I just don't say anything. You know, there's no motivation there to act the way I used to act. Even the way I acted several years in sobriety, because, you know, that I used to do some goofy stuff sober. You know, there were periods in there where I was just a very, very angry guy. I can remember at 4 years sober, I used to sit up in my second-story apartment window with a loaded military rifle, round in the chamber, bolt closed, finger on the trigger, no safety, and sight the passers-by as they walk down the street. That's not very well. And, you know, once again, I'm not proud of that, but I've done it. You know, and I've done it sober. Chemically sober. Today, I believe that's untreated alcoholism, pure and simple. You know, because the thing about it is, we've got a line in our book that says something the effect of yet letting drink for a day, and he can become disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. In the untreated state, what that can look like is let him be selfish and dishonest for a day, and he can become disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. Because I was still selfish and dishonest at that stage in my life. And I was dishonest can be as simple as not letting anybody know what's going on with you. I am closed. I am not honest. If I am not open, I am being dishonest. I have come to believe that. I've got to let somebody know what is going on with me against what my intellect tells me to do. I will probably be on amends for a while yet. I've managed to run up a big chunk of stuff I owe, some of which I ran up in sobriety, too. That's just a matter of set up a payment plan, make the payments. That's really not that big a deal. Some of the ones I had to go back and redo were amends, especially like with my mother. You know, that consisted of things like listening about that night, about worrying her to death, New Year's Day of 1990, or 91, whichever year it was. One of the amends I really missed the boat on was my father, and I didn't realize how continually angry I had been at him. And I was to the point, and my current sponsor had asked me about that, and I had poo-pooed it. And Dad was getting ill, and he went in the hospital. And we figured he probably didn't have too many more rounds of this, but, you know, the old guy was so terrified of dying, I figured he'd postpone it absolutely as long as he could. And as it turned out, he died. And at least my brother had borne the burden of dealing with Dad in his last illness, and, you know, I did pitch in and try to be a good brother to him. Not because that's a living amends, but that's because that's what brothers are supposed to do. That's what family does for one another. You know, it ain't about keeping score anymore, and I was a great scorekeeper for years. But it dawned on me about 2 months later, I wound up writing inventory on Dad. And, you know, it dawned on me, too, that I had really blown it. You know, I had absolutely missed the opportunity while he was alive. Not so much that I need a daddy, that's not the case, but the point is that, you know, at least I could have cleared up some of that crud. Dad, bless his heart, was fairly seriously mentally ill, but, you know, nevertheless, I could have left things a lot neater than I did, and I didn't. So, you know, I can counsel promptness in the amends process, especially with family. You know, if you're in a situation where it's looking kind of iffy, you can go to the graveyard. But, you know, quite frankly, it's, to me, I just don't believe there's anybody there. You know, it's a 3x6 hunk of dirt with a piece of marble sitting at one end of it, and that's what it is. I did what I could do, but I sure did blow what I could have done. I do try to keep my side of the street swept off today, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Work is my big goofy thing. I did get a job in sobriety. Funny, you know, it's one of those things. The phone rang, hey, would you come work for us? I didn't do that. As a matter of fact, I've had two jobs in sobriety and have worked for myself, and I didn't make any of that stuff happen. They were all phone calls. You know, I put, when I was in business for myself, I put God in charge of sales. And I remember every time work was running low, you know, once in a while I started to worry about it. And sure enough, within a day or two, you know, long before I worked myself out into inactivity, the phone had rung. There was something else to do. You know, I've never done without. I've had strange things happen in my thinking, like the day I came home and my apartment door was kicked in and most of my stuff was gone. And, of course, you wind up with that angry, violated feeling. And yet, within about less than 2 minutes, it had dawned on me that everything of value, i.e., the two people who were there, me and my son, we're fine. It's just stuff. Don't like it. But it's just stuff. And that's a totally, you know, that's totally foreign to my natural, vengeful self. My prayer life to me today is very important. You know, and today having service commitments and being available for others in AA is very important. These are the kinds of things that, you know, I don't always do these things very well. You know, sometimes I have meeting chairs wondering where the hell the speaker is at 6 o'clock as he pulls in the parking lot for a 6 o'clock meeting. You know, yeah, progress, not perfection. Today, you know, in that episode, yeah, that's my cop-out. But nevertheless, you know, we keep coming. We keep coming. We keep doing what it is they tell us to do. And some days, you know, some days I just don't want to. Some days when the phone rings, I got a phone call Thursday afternoon from a guy I used to sponsor years ago. And, you know, bless his heart, he dragged back in. He's been back around about 9 days now. And because he took it back, you know, and sooner or later he back out there with it. And he was always a peculiar guy, but then again, I wouldn't expect to get the well ones. By the way, which of us in here is the well one? It ain't me. But he told me while we were on the phone, he said, I remember one thing you told me years ago. You told me that God would do for me what I couldn't do for myself, but he wouldn't lift a finger for me for the things I could do for myself. I said, well, that sounds like something I would have said at that point. I said, today I believe that, you know, God isn't going to do for me what I can do for myself, but he'll certainly help me if I let him. And that's probably as good a place to close as any. Thanks.